Welcome to Foreman & Wolf on Food & Wine. I'm Tony Foreman.
And Chef Cindy Wolf.
And today we're talking about something that's really close to both of our hearts, Southern food.
Absolutely.
And so what makes you excited about Southern food? What's the thing that got you started or sparked on cooking that food?
When I was a little girl, we lived in Rocky Mount, North Carolina, and the lady across the street was an amazing cook, and she had grown up in that town, and her grandparents were from there, and, you know, getting to have my first cup of sweet tea and a pound cake and all these wonderful, actually, tomatoes with sugar, which as a kid, that was pretty good. You know, my mother and father were from York, Pennsylvania, so her cooking was so very different from what I was eating at home, and I just, you know, that was a treat. Everything was sweet, it seemed like, but it was also steeped in, you know, local product and, you know, great fresh vegetables, and, you know, she was a great cook.
And it's funny when you say everything was sweet. I end up having at times a chip on my shoulder about Southern food, because I may not sound a whole lot like a Southerner, but I grew up with a great grandmother who was a fantastic Southern cook, and she wasn't the person that did everything fried, and she wasn't the person that did. It's not that a fried chicken wasn't great, but it it's not that everything was pickled, because she did make good pickles,
right?
And she did make great dessert. But I just don't. I end up being bothered by when people only think of Southern food as sweet, you know, fried chicken with pancakes and waffles, or you know, and syrup and all this.
Well, and a lot of the things people would have gotten maybe in a roadside restaurant in the South, where maybe they weren't doing their best cooking, because the best cooking was done in the home, in the
South.
I
mean, it's agriculturally driven food.
Absolutely.
You know, from pretty generous countryside, that in the home, and a lot of patient cooking and a lot of labor-intensive cooking.
Well, and you had a culture that the food was based on rice eating. You know, the rice cookery, I guess, would be a better way of putting it. And
well, I mean, you're talking specifically about South Carolina or Louisiana, where you can actually cultivate rice.
Absolutely.
Now, the two big melting pot cuisines of the South are a little bit different from the rest of the South, right?
Yes.
Because the Southern U.S. is a huge area with a bunch of different settlements, with different timelines, and some different cultures. But the two things people tend to think of primarily are which two, Sin?
Well, South Carolina Lowcountry cooking and New Orleans cooking. And, you know, South Carolina had sort of a... Yes?
I'm going to ask you the foolish question. How are they different?
They're very different because of how they were settled. And the original lands in South Carolina were granted to Barbadian planters in the late 1600s. And those planters had been granted their lands in Barbados by the English king. So you have a sort of a Creole influence on an English person who then moves to South Carolina and then has, you know, all these wonderful things that are growing in South Carolina. And you have the Native American influence on that cooking, as well as, of course, eventually the West African influence on the cooking. And in New Orleans, we all know it was, you know, French and really Spanish cooking that greatly influenced. And you had different rules at different times. So, you know, it's also a coastal area. So that's probably one of the similarities between the cooking, but you have different spices. You also have the fact that Charleston and New Orleans were sea areas and or coastal areas that were, you know, had ships coming in that were bringing them all kinds of wonderful spices and things that you might not have gotten further inland, or would have been harder to have gotten further inland.
Well, I guess if New Orleans was, you know, French as it kind of grew up as far as its control, its trade routes are going to be different than Charleston, which was English and had very different trade routes. I mean, Charleston, for example, super famous Madeira port for the U.S.
Which is an amazing, you know, when you're in Charleston, you almost always are served Madeira in the afternoon in the little inns. And it's been such a big part of that culture. You should tell everybody about how Madeira came about.
Well, Madeira was ballast on ships. They were the colonies, we think about it, the colonies are poor. They still want a drink, still English colonies. The cheapest drink was the worst wine. The worst wine was coming from the island of Madeira, which was super acidic because it's a volcanic island. And the trade routes were between Great Britain, Spain, Madeira, which is a stopping off point from Spain before, if you want to cut across the Atlantic, to go into the Caribbean and then up the U.S. coast. What they found was that the wine that was horrible that left the island of Madeira after all of that travel as ballast in the ships at that heat and in that humidity for months and months and months in the super hot temperatures, the wine kind of slowly cooked. And as the wine slowly cooked, it became a lot more interesting to drink. And it was something that was sweet but had very good acidity and had this sort of caramelly flavor, raisiny, creme brulee, pastry shop kind of aromas.
Which went really well with the food that they were cooking.
Yeah.
So it was perfect.
It was, the legend of George Washington was he was such a big Madeira fan, he drank a pint of Madeira with his dinner every day.
Oh, gosh.
Now, dinner in the South is what time of the day usually, traditionally?
You'd think of in the early part of the day at lunchtime because you do tend to have a heavier meal when the husband would have come home from work for lunch and the children would have come home from school, and then you might have had something lighter later on in the evening, in the summertime especially.
Yeah, I mean, if it's the agriculturally driven lifestyle, it's, especially in the warm part of the year, you're up early and cooking, getting things ready, serving a warm meal before it gets hottest, napping when it gets hottest,
mm-hmm.
And maybe drinking off that or sleeping off the Madeira that you drank with your lunch.
Well, the influences, when you think about what was, you had all the game, all the wonderful, clams and oysters and crabs and the fish from that seacoast, and particularly in the Lowcountry area of South Carolina. You had, as time went on, street vendors that would call out what they had, as they went through the streets, and the cooks would come out and buy from them. And, these things were also such an important part of the culture, and the way that they entertained was also a part of, had influences on the cooking. And, I bet they cooked a little bit with Madeira, too. You've got it. You're going to cook with it. So
you would think so. Mm-hmm. So what are some dishes, just because people will identify much more with specifics, what are the 3, 4, 5 dishes that are typically low country, like Charleston, Savannah, that whole area, essentially mm-hmm. from the coastal South Carolina area?
Well, there are a couple of rice dishes that are very traditional. Limp and Susan, which would be okra and rice. Red rice, which is simply tomato in with the rice when you're cooking it. It could be tomato puree, it could be fresh tomato. Or Hop and John, which is really, sort of the perlo or pilo is what was actually referred to as the state dish of South Carolina. So it was a dish because rice was enjoyed at every meal and was a huge part of all the cooking. You think of one-pot dishes, so that's what a perlo is, P-E-R-L-A-U, and it was spelled a lot of different ways. And when you go to look at the old cookbooks, it has many different spellings. But
I wonder if that's almost like a bastardized version of pilaf.
Exactly.
A little bit like Shiraz in mm-hmm. Australia is for Syrah.
Okay. Exactly, it is. And, the idea is that the simplest perlo, cooking black-eyed peas with a piece of fat back and then adding rice to the pot at the end of the cooking so that it absorbs all that wonderful flavor, to a more exotic perlo, which would have had, mussels and clams and shrimp and maybe a local fish. And again, allowing that wonderful broth to be absorbed by the rice, and you have this just amazing dish. And it kind of all comes back to, and also spoon bread. It's another thing that, as a chef, I had to figure out how to adapt a spoon bread recipe to a restaurant use, because that was something that would have been laid out in a dish and put on the sideboard for breakfast, and you would have just literally spooned it out. It was more of a custard-based dish, even though it was called spoon bread. And, of course, you have sheet crab soup, which is very traditional to Charleston, and that's all about cream and crab and a little bit of mace and probably a little bit of sherry being used.
What's the she part of sheet crab soup?
They would use the female crabs. They always felt that the vendors, again, would call out she crabs, in the streets, because everyone felt that the female crab was better tasting, and it also had the luck of the roe, and roe was used as a thickening agent in the soups back in the days. So that roe also had tremendous flavor to your soup.
When I was a little kid, the one thing that was horrifying was my great-grandmother, who was a fantastic cook, would make me eat. She would attempt to make me eat grits.
Oh, you didn't like grits when you were little?
Well, it was always this sort of just like soupy, grainy.
Well, got it.
Charmless.
I'm with you now.
It's just
because it was from a box.
It's as all of a sudden my nanny, who was this wonderful, warm person that could, transform anything with her hands into like a magical dish.
Mm-hmm.
Somehow the picture went black and white, and she all of a sudden was from Connecticut or something. And this is just the worst gruel in the world. And I wondered what I had done wrong to offend God.
Well, thankfully now we have wonderful mills in our country that are grinding grits. And we use Anson's Mill. And Glenn Roberts, who runs Anson's Mill, was actually the general manager of the restaurant where I did my apprenticeship in Charleston when I was 19 years old. And so I've known him a very long time. And he has searched out, you know, the heirloom variety corn that was grown at the time, you know, in the 1800s, whenever. And this is what they grind for their grits, and they grind them fresh. We place an order, they grind them in stones, you know, in the old way. And
so that's the difference. The grits that you make, or the grits that are available to consumers to make now,
mm-hmm.
are just a lot fresher.
Oh, they're amazing.
And superior.
Mm-hmm.
The corn product.
The texture, yeah. The you start, as always, you have to have a great product to start. And, you know, once you have something that has more texture than the boxed grits, and that freshness and that wonderful flavor from the product, grits are great. It does take a long time to cook them, almost an hour, very slowly. You know, when we make grits, we do one part grits to four parts liquid. We use milk. So four cups of milk, one cup of grits, and I put a tiny bit of butter in and a little bit of salt from the very beginning, and you just stir them very gently on low heat the whole time, and so good.
Yeah, no. Now I have them. I have yours. It's. I mean, that you smell.
It's kind of
you
like
smell,
a miracle.
You smell the sweet corn.
Right.
Well, it is, because everything's in color now.
So
everything
good.
Is
exactly.
Reasonable.
Exactly. Well, and they're a great foil for a lot of different things. I mean, you know, you can have them with shrimp. Obviously, the traditional dish is shrimp and grits. And when I make them, I put andouille sausage and tasso ham, and, you know, deglaze with a little bit of white wine and add cold butter to make a pan sauce and finish with a little bit of chive. And if you can get the shrimp with the heads on, what's so appealing about that preparation is there's that pocket of fat in the back of the head of the shrimp that melts out during the cooking process and creates color and flavor. I mean, your sauce is going to be coral colored because of that fat, and the flavor really does add to the dish.
I mean, the classic breakfast dish down there
historically
is shrimp, garlic, and grits.
Right.
And that's just, you know, shrimp with the heads on in the pan with the garlic and served over grits. And
exactly.
And you're done. Maybe have a glass of Madeira with that as your breakfast and go right to sleep.
Well, you know what? You would probably do that after you're out shrimping all night, which is where that dish kind of comes from.
Well, when we come back on Foreman Wolf on Food and Wine, we're not going to be shrimping, and we're not going to be drinking Madeira with breakfast, but we'll be trying to dispel a few other, sort of negative rumors and cliches about Southern food.
Southern food's a beautiful thing.